Hi, seid ihr bereit für eine neue Folge Brett Time Stories? Der maßlose Brettspiel-Podcast aus dem Westflügel Remscheids und der Dunkelkammer Bochums. Mit Haider und dem Potti. Zwei Typen, die früher mal cool waren. Viel Vergnügen.
Tag Leute, schön, dass ihr eingeschaltet habt. Ihr seht es, oder ja, ich sage immer, ihr seht es, aber es hören ja auch viele Leute zu. Der Daniel ist wieder unten. Wir haben drei Felder frei. Das heißt ja, mein Gast, und ich begrüße euch recht herzlich zu dieser, echt, ich bin sehr, sehr aufgeregt, zu dieser wundervollen Folge Brett Time Stories. Ich bin's, der Poddy. Und ich gebe jetzt ab an den einzig wahren Eros Ramazzotti alias Daniel Haider.
Slip inside the eye of your mind. Don't you know you might find a better place to play? Hallo Potti, hallo Guest. So we will introduce our guest in a couple of seconds.
Was war das jetzt für ein Lied? Ich habe eine Idee gehabt, aber ich komme nicht drauf. Das klang sehr bekannt.
Maybe we can ask our guest.
Okay, machen wir gleich.
Give another hint.
Wie geht's dir denn, Daniel? Bist du gut gestartet? Hast du dich auf heute gefreut? Du wusstest ja schon länger, was heute auf uns wartet.
Ja, also ich habe mich sehr gefreut. Ich bin nach wie vor wirklich überrascht, wer so alles partizipiert bei uns im Podcast, wer als Gast oder wen er als Gast immer ranholt. Ich habe ja auch schon mal versucht, den einen oder anderen Deutschsprachigen ranzuholen. Aber man muss tatsächlich sagen, wirklich mit mäßigem bis gar keinem Erfolg. Und ich bin immer wieder überrascht, wenn du mir dann präsentierst und sagst, hör mal, weißt du, wer nächste Woche bei uns im Podcast ist? Dann sag ich, hey, wie nächste Woche, krass. Und ich freue mich ganz besonders, ganz besonderer Gast auch. Ich besitze auch ein Spiel von ihm und nicht so das gängige. Ich weiß nicht, ich halte es mal rein, vielleicht weiß dann schon der Erste, wer es sein könnte.
Ne? Jetzt konnte man es ja schon fast lesen. Ich besitze tatsächlich mehr Spiele von ihm. Und freue mich auch riesig. Manchmal ist es Zufall, ja. Ich habe zu dem einen oder anderen manchmal nehme ich selber Kontakt auf. Ich kann ja auch schon sagen, dass sich noch ein weiteres Schwergewicht schon mit mir im Kontakt befindet. Und wenn das klappt, das wäre auch ein richtig krasses Ding. Allerdings ist da bin ich gerade noch dabei, den Haiderschen Charme spielen zu lassen. Da muss ich mal gucken.
The International Heavyweights in our show.
International Heavyweights, genau. Bevor wir aber jetzt unseren Gast introducen, vielleicht mal ganz kurz ein, zwei Neuerungen. Und zwar, ihr habt ja auf die Folge mit Jamie Stackmeyer habt ihr uns ja viel Resonanz gegeben. Und darauf haben wir entschieden. Einfach, wir versuchen natürlich immer so weitestgehend euch alle zufriedenzustellen. Manchmal macht Sinn, manchmal nicht, manchmal klappt's besser, manchmal weniger. Und wir haben uns dazu entschlossen, dass wir diese Folge wie folgt aufnehmen werden. Das heißt, es wird auf YouTube eine rein englische Folge geben. Also rein englisch bedeutet, das Interview wird rein englisch sein. Also ne, das Intro und so wird sich natürlich nicht verändern, weil man dort halt die Untertitel einstellen kann. Ich hoffe, dass der YouTube-Translator das dann auch vernünftig macht. Und mir hat nämlich irgendwann mal eine Freundin geschrieben, dass YouTube da komplett Grütze übersetzt hat. Und dann wird es für die Podcast-Medien wie Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast und Deezer und Podigy wird es dann zwei Versionen geben. Das heißt, wir werden eine Version hochladen, die rein auf Englisch ist und für all diejenigen unter euch, die bisher immer Sorge hatten, dass der Daniel zu wenig Redeanteil hatte. Der Daniel wird dann nämlich den Podcast übersetzen, so dass ihr dann quasi auch eine Version quasi auf Deutsch und eine Version auf Englisch habt. So, und dann möchten wir unseren Gast jetzt gar nicht so lang warten lassen. Ladies and Gentlemen, please welcome the one and the only Martin Wallace, straight from Australia. Hi, Martin.
Welcome.
Hi there. Hello. Hi.
How you doing?
So, I'm very well, thank you. Yes. I have an easy life. I work from home, so I get up in the morning, lie in for as long as I want. I get up, feed the cats, amble about the house, play solitaire for a few hours on the computer, and then sometimes I do a little bit of work. Occasionally, you know, then I'll go off and sleep in the hammock for a while, and then, yeah, life is good.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah. Sounds really great, yes.
Yeah, maybe we can change our lives.
Well, see, Juliet, my wife, you see, she's the one that works hard. She's the one that goes out and earns all the money. So she's actually working overnight tonight, well, last night and tonight. So that also means when she's working evenings, I also get to watch whatever I want on Netflix. So yeah, life could not be better.
How many cats do you have?
Cats. We have four cats altogether. Yeah.
Oh, four.
Four cats. Okay.
Yeah. We used to have more, but when we moved to New Zealand in 2013, we took five cats with us, which cost an awful lot of money.
Okay.
But they don't like cats in Australia because they're not good for the bird population. So there's a guy down the street. We've just moved house recently. So we're in a new house. Just bought our own house. But apparently there's a guy just down the road who, if he sees a cat, he'll shoot it. So we're hoping the cats don't wander that far down. Oh. Yeah, that's Australia for you.
Oh, that's cruel.
So we are two dog households here. Hottie and I own a dog. If you talk to my daughter, Heidi, she would rather recommend to buy two cats.
Yes. cats are easier to maintain. I mean, yeah, and they make less noise. Dogs, they bark a lot. I mean, I like dogs.
I'm just an owner of one dog, but he's also very expensive. He's snacking all the hairs on my head. but he's a very nice guy. So Daniel knows him also. And I think he's a very, very calm and very smart dog.
He's not barking much. My dog as well, he's not barking.
It's like the owner. He's
very good domesticated.
The owner of my dog isn't also barking all the time.
Oh my goodness. So Martin, did you recognize the song? So you were smart.
Yes, it was an Oasis song. I'm trying to remember the exact track, but I get the Manchester connection, yeah.
Yes. Right. So I chose this song.
Yeah.
I chose this song. In the last episode, I chose an Oasis song as well because this was my New Year's party song. So I chose what was it, Potty?
Wonderwall.
A Wonderwall. So
that was usually the one people sing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. When I did my research and I recognized your connection to Manchester, so I had to choose an Oasis song once again. Mm. So when Jamie Stegmaier participated, he's in St. Louis, I chose a song by a rapper from St. Louis. So he recognized that as well. And he was laughing. So this is my gift for you. So for today, angel voice.
But Martin, one short question. So you said when you went to New Zealand, but now you're living in Australia, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I just...
Yes, since 2017.
Yes. Yeah.
Daniel is our researcher. He knows it better. So Martin, short for our audience, would you say a few words who you are and what you are doing?
Hi, I'm Martin Wallace. I'm a game designer. You mean what I'm doing at the moment? What am I working on at the moment? Or
maybe if you want.
As you like.
Yeah, feel free.
It's always a difficult question, this, because I'm working on lots of stuff, but I'm not sure if I'm meant to mention certain stuff. So, for instance, it's like I'm working on some follow-up stuff for Anno 1800, but it's not been made public yet. So Wolfgang might shout at me if I mention this. So but then I've already mentioned it, so he'll probably shout at me anyway. Working on some more Anno stuff. I'm actually working on some role-playing game stuff at the moment, which is unusual for me because it's not normally what I do, but I'm kind of investigating, looking into games with stronger storylines, stronger plot lines. I'm also hoping to work on some stuff with David Turtsey. We're meant to be talking sometime later this week. You know, he wants to do a co-design. So we've got some ideas floating around for that. So, and then at some point in the next couple of months, doing a Kickstarter for Bloodstones. So that'll probably be next big game from me. also say we've got a tennis trail out on Kickstarter at the moment, and there's also a Kickstarter for an expansion for Australia due in the next month or two. Okay. So lots of stuff going on.
Yeah. So I'm also an owner of some games. A few. I'm just have to look at my shelf. I own Anno. I'm a very, very as I saw this game on for Cosmos, and I said, oh, that could be a very, very interesting game. And so the feedback from very, very from the most of the players I'm talking to are very positive. I haven't played it because of Corona, so that's a problem. So I'm also
What is it? Struggle of Empire.
Struggle of Empire. Age of Steam is also a game from Martin. I own Brass. And are there more? I'm not sure at the moment, but there are some games. So I'm
Nantinarking. You also own Nantinarking? No.
I owned it, but Nantinarking. but Nantinarking isn't a game from Martin. The original game is
Discworld.
Ankh-Morpork, correct. So,
Nantinarking. Yeah, which was my design.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
Martin, so what you are drinking now, because we have a drink of the episode, and what's your drink?
Drinking water, unfortunately, because it's dry January.
it's dry January.
December we usually drink a lot, so January we give our livers a month off. So it's a bit boring, I'm afraid. Normally by this time I would have had a couple of beers or a bottle of wine or something, or a little glass of whiskey.
But now it's
by my drink.
But now it's water. Yeah, but now it's dry January. When I was younger, so in Germany we are celebrating Carnival. So in the region where I was growing up, and afterwards there are the few 4 weeks after Carnival there were my dry weeks, so I didn't drink anything. But today it's the same because it's 10 a.m. in Bochum, and so I just drink clear water. So
it's a bit, it'd be a bit worrying if you're drinking beer at 10 o'clock in the morning. Apparently, one of the previous owners of this house was a full-time alcoholic. So she would go next door at 10 o'clock in the morning with a couple of beers, and the guy there would be like, my God, what's going on? So
in Germany, we had an entertainer. I think he died almost. And his name was Harald Juncker. And he said his big point of life. And he said what happiness is for him, no meetings. And a little bit drunken.
So we have a German entertainer as well. He was famous in the 1990s, I think. He's called Harald Schmidt. And Harald Schmidt always started his shows with Ja zu deutschem Wasser. Say yes to German water. real fun. So we say yes to water as well. So I'm just waiting for a connection to the famous company Gerolsteiner in Germany, but they won't give me a contract. I don't know why.
So we are all drinking water. It's the dry episode today. Maybe it's the title, the dry episode. Daniel, would you start a small recap from the last episode? Maybe the
okay, now
be in German and
yes, I will do the recap. Do you understand a few German words,
Martin? I'm afraid not. No.
Okay.
So it mean nothing to me. So if you want to be rude, you can be rude.
Okay. So lean.
I just lean
back
and
enjoy.
Yeah.
Lean back, enjoy, drink your water, have some fun, and in a couple of minutes you are back. Wir haben das neue Jahr gestartet in der letzten Folge. Der Potti und ich in trauter Zweisamkeit hatten kurzfristig überlegt, sollen wir ein bisschen was aus dem alten Jahr mitnehmen oder sollen wir eigentlich lieber einen Ausblick auf das neue Jahr nehmen oder geben, und haben uns letzten Endes dazu entschieden, dass wir uns darauf verständigen, was liegt an, was haben wir für Pläne, wie soll es weitergehen, aber auch doch in Zügen haben wir nochmal kurz das Jahr Revue passieren lassen, nicht mit Messe- oder Spielegeschichten, sondern eher so unseren persönlichen Eindrücken. Der Podcast ist ja im letzten Jahr gestartet und auch ganz gut durchgestartet, würde ich jetzt mal sagen. Wir haben, glaube ich, auch einen guten Wiedererkennungswert und freuen uns dann dementsprechend auch darüber und kriegen eigentlich durchweg auch immer schönes, anregendes Feedback. Das haben wir nochmal durchleuchtet, haben nochmal selber uns ja hinterfragt und überlegt, wie wir es gestalten wollen, haben in der letzten Woche schon mal eine neue Struktur überlegt. Vielleicht habt ihr davon nicht so viel mitbekommen, aber wir wollen das Ganze schon ein bisschen gestreamliner haben und auch letztlich Hörer zugewandt sein. Das heißt, wir wollen nicht irgendwie 4 Stunden labern und dann den Kern irgendwie vernachlässigen, sondern versuchen das Ganze dann stetig immer wieder für euch knackig und entspannt zu halten. Was auch nicht unbedingt immer passieren wird, da entschuldige ich mich schon mal im Vorfeld, denn wir sind halt auch hauptberuflich mit anderen Dingen beschäftigt und das ist unser privates Hobby und Vergnügen und wir versuchen das Beste zu geben, aber ab und zu bricht's mal mit uns durch und dann kommentieren wir gerne oder schwatzen darüber, aber ich denke, gerade der Mix daraus aus Struktur und einfach mal loslassen, ist, glaube ich, das Schöne, was so jetzt das Jahr ausgemacht hat. Wir haben quasi die Höhen und Tiefen beleuchtet und haben dann auch bestimmte Dinge dann nochmal auf den Tisch kommen lassen, haben auch über Spiele und über allen möglichen Kladderadatsch gesprochen, sodass letzten Endes das Feedback auch zur Folge, auch privat, was ich bekommen habe, recht positiv war. Also viele haben gesagt, boah, war eine tolle Folge, cooler Einstieg ins neue Jahr und war natürlich auch wieder mit ein paar philosophischen Fragen geprägt. Der Potti hatte nochmal ein geiles Weiße-Weiße-Kennst-du für mich vorbereitet, was sehr, sehr amüsant war. Und so wollen wir halt weiter ins neue Jahr starten. Haben ja auch einen Ausblick gegeben, dass wir einige Gäste haben werden und dass wir die Zweierfolgen aber dann auch im Wechsel immer haben wollen. Und das wär's soweit gewesen. Willst du noch was ergänzen, Potti, ne?
Nö, da bin ich immer wunschlos glücklich, wenn du das machst. Also zur Struktur sagen wir auch einfach in der nächsten Folge nochmal was, weil wir das in der nächsten Folge dann auch proaktiv umsetzen werden. Insofern, da werden so 1-2 kleine Neuerungen auf euch zukommen. Im Prinzip nichts Wildes, aber wir haben halt einfach gesagt, dass wir den Fokus ein bisschen mehr auf das Hauptthema legen wollen und deswegen haben wir ein bisschen aufgeräumt quasi. Und aber da sagst du, sagen wir was. In der nächsten Folge. Dann würde ich sagen, starten wir einfach mit den Kommentaren. Auch da haben wir ja gesagt, dass wir das Ganze nur noch auf 3 bis 5 Kommentare streamlinen werden. Das fällt diesmal leicht, weil die letzte Folge, da war ging es entweder hauptsächlich um das Trikot, was ich anhatte in den Kommentaren, oder um ein bestimmtes Spiel. Und deswegen kralle ich mir da jetzt mal ein bisschen raus und ich fange erstmal an mit Duzetem. Und zwar so, bin zwar mit der Folge noch nicht durch, aber will aber eine Frage zumindest zum Teil beantworten. Das Kartenspiel aus Spanien kann ich leider nicht komplett erklären, aber zum Teil. Was du, Heider, beschreibst, klingt nach den spanisch-italienischen Karten, Schwerter, Kelche, Münzen, Stäbe. Bei uns wohl am bekanntesten das französische Blatt, Kreuz, Pik, Herz, Karo und das deutsche Blatt, Eiche, Laub, Herz, Schellen. Was genau ihr damit spieltet, kann ich nicht sagen, erkenne ich nur das italienische Scopa, spricht sich bei uns Scopa, also mit kurzem O. Ein kurzweiliges und dadurch unterhaltsames Stichspiel, bei dem jeder Spieler 3 Karten auf der Hand hat und reihum versucht, aus einer der in der Mitte befindlichen Auslagekarten mit gleichem Wert herauszustechen. Gelingt das nicht, muss eine Karte aus der Hand der Auslage hinzugefügt werden. Nachdem alle Spieler ihre 3 Karten gespielt haben, gibt es 3 neue Handkarten. Solange bis alle Karten gespielt wurden, einige Bekanntheit hat das Spiel durch die filmische Umsetzung von Don Camillo und Peppone bekommen, wo es gespielt wird. Besonderheit, es gibt viele Varianten. Daher kann es mit unterschiedlich vielen Menschen gespielt werden, 2 bis 5, aber vielleicht hilft das ja ein wenig bei der Suche nach dem spanischen Spiel weiter. Und dann schließe ich mal ganz kurz den Kommentar von Michael an, der hat nämlich auch geschrieben, ich glaube, das Kartenspiel ist italienisch und ich kenne 2 Spiele, die mit den Karten möglich sind, heißen Scopa und Briscola. Hat dich das so ein bisschen, hat dir das geholfen, Daniel?
Ja, ich habe danach recherchiert, aber ich habe auch ein paar YouTube-Videos geguckt zu diesem Spiel und bin nicht schlau aus den Regeln geworden. Aber das ist es, ja, genau, Scopa.
Okay, Martin, do you know
Italian the game Scopa
or Briscola?
Sorry?
Do you know the game Scopa? It's a card game?
No, I don't think I've heard Scopa.
In the last episode, I was talking about a game that I was playing in Spain with other children.
Right.
And so they gave a card game. So it's not Ace and Spades and like we are familiar with. It's another kind of artwork in this game. So I found it because a follower gave us the title of the game Scopa, but when I looked up the rules, I didn't understand anything. So the status quo was nearly the same.
But when Daniel talked about the game, I have to mention that I also don't know the game, so I was lost when Daniel was talking about it. But
is this an old traditional Spanish card game then?
Yes. Or right. Italian, mostly Italian.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So Daniel, what means Stichspiel in English?
Well, trick-taking game.
Trick-taking game. Okay.
So it's a trick-taking game.
Oh, Daniel. Okay, dann ein Kommentar, einfach um das Thema abzurunden. In der letzten Folge habe ich ja das Sturm Graz Trikot angehabt, was der Roland mir geschickt hat, was ja auch wieder für viel Aufsehen gesorgt hat. Ich wurde auf den diversesten Medien angesprochen, warum Graz, ob ich Bezüge in die Stadt habe und so weiter und so fort. Und da, wie gesagt, geht nochmal ein Riesendank raus an den Roland. Roland hat sich auch nochmal kurz zu Wort gemeldet. Danke, war etwas peinlich berührt. Hat mich vor allem gefreut, dass du es für dich auch als für dich auch ein Zeichen war, dass es nicht nur Hater oder, wie du sagen würdest, konstruktive Kritiker gibt. PS wurden wie nicht in Graz, falls du mal in der Gegend bist. Ich sage ja nicht, dass es nur konstruktive Kritiker gibt, aber es war natürlich trotzdem schön, beziehungsweise das ist ja so der Grund, warum wir das ja auch tun, weil wir ja irgendwie uns freuen, mit Leuten eine gute Zeit zu haben. Und ich habe ihm auch direkt geantwortet, dass wir, oder ich, wenn wir irgendwann mal in der Nähe sind, Daniel, vielleicht kriegen wir es ja irgendwann mal hin. Wien steht noch auf meiner Liste. Hon versus Alex sitzen ja auch in Wien. Also da sind ja so 1, 2, 3 Leute und Potti-Wochenende ist ja auch.
Oh, jetzt hast du aber einen fatalen Fehler begangen. Die sitzen in der Schweiz.
Sitzen ja, ah nee, die sind in Zürich. Ah, Zürich. Hast recht.
Zürich.
Okay, dann müssen wir, das ist ein kleiner Umweg, aber aufgrund dieses Fauxpas würden wir es jetzt auch mal machen.
Swiss or Austria, never mind.
Martin, do you watching soccer or football?
Not at the moment, no. We don't, our TV's not hooked up to terrestrial. So the only TV I get is via the internet. So that'd be Netflix or Amazon. I don't want to pay. One of the big TV channels over here is Foxtel, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who you may have heard of. And I object to giving him money, so I won't sign up for Foxtel. So I occasionally follow the sport by reading The Guardian. I sort of follow Manchester United. But being but being so far from home, I've kind of drifted away from that. So no, I'm not watching football at the moment.
Okay, when I'm thinking about Manchester United, there's one movie which is called Eurotrip. Do you know the movie? Daniel, do you know the movie? Yes. So laughing. In Eurotrip, there's a guy from the US and he has an email friendship with a girl in Germany. And all the time, a friend of him says that, oh, he's a man and he wants to touch your genitals. And so then he breaks up the contact and his brother shows him, no, that's Mieke, it's a girl. And so he's traveling from USA to Germany because he wants to say to her that he's in love. And they also, at first they travel to London. And so the American guys want to drink some beer and are stepping into a pub, and it's a Manchester United pub, only for fans of Manchester United.
Yeah.
And then they are singing some songs. At first, they want to beat them, but afterwards, they're with a bus traveling to France, and they are hooligans and want to beat some.
So it's a really cliche film, full of cliches. Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
Eurotrip. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool movie. So let's start with two more
Comments. Stefan Bierwirt hat geschrieben, wieder eine schöne Folge, danke für die Erwähnung meines Kommentars bezüglich Spieleanschaffung. Geht mir genauso wie euch. Man nimmt vor, sich weniger zu konsumieren und bewusster Spiele zu kaufen. Ob es dann was wird, ist sehr fraglich. Auf den Brettspieljahrgang 2021 freue ich mich extrem und hat auch schon geil angefangen. Gloomhaven, ein paar Szenarien gespielt. Anak war ein paar Mal auf dem Tisch, genauso wie Seventh Continent. Letzte Woche ist bei mir Kanban Electric Vehicles, mein erster Lacerda angekommen. Was ein geiles Spiel mit Hammerausstattung. Bin extrem begeistert und angefixt. Aktuell bestelle ich noch Too Many Bones, Prager Caput Regni und Cloud Age. Freue mich drauf und auf euren nächsten Podcast. Martin, so are you also looking forward for the year 2021? What's coming up with games? So you get your games and other big games?
I'm looking forward to 2001 in the sense that hopefully it'll be better than, you know, 2020. So, but I think everybody is hoping that. Just looking forward to when the world returns to some degree of normality. In terms of looking forward to other designs, I don't really buy games. I play them obviously, but I usually play games other friends of mine or people at the club have acquired. But I'm not somebody that really looks forward to what new games are coming out. It's just a case of when stuff comes out. What I usually do is wait till something comes out, and then those games that people talk about a lot, that get a lot of buzz, they'll be like, yeah, okay, let's go and see if I can get a game of that and see what it's like, which is more a case of doing market research or just trying to, you know, understand why that game might be popular. An example would be last weekend at the Games Club, somebody had a copy of Dwellers of Eldervale, which is pretty new. And I thought, well, it's quite, you know, again, you've got to remember we're in Australia. So a lot of these big Kickstarter games don't always make their way here. So I thought, no, it'd be interesting to see what that's like, you know, as a designer, you know, just to see, you know, what people like in this game, what people don't like in this game, you know, just because I do like to open myself to other game designs just to see what, you know, what ideas other game designers have.
Okay. This is a good point to interrupt you. So I noticed, I made up one question. So this is because you lived in Europe for a long while. So, you know, the Australian market. Maybe you know the German market, maybe as well the US market. So are there significant differences in the market, how the market works, how game copies sell, how you design games to that market?
I think there are significant differences now. I mean, when I first started, the only market was the German market. That was the market for Euro games. I'm talking about going back to the 1990s now when I first went over to Essen. So yeah, the majority of your sales will be over there. And the market, because of that, the market was so much smaller. Now, obviously, the market specifically in America has exploded. I mean, it is massive. And I think that is having a direct impact on what kind of games sell. So the kind of games that you're seeing, like Dwellers of Eldervale, Gloomhaven, these big games with lots of plastic pieces in, I mean, those just could not have existed 20 years ago. You know, they're not Euro, you know, they're not, you know, it's moving away from Euro games. So games that are, I suppose, you know, a lot more thematic or, you know, a lot more complex, those games now can actually sell in reasonable numbers. There is actually a market for those games. You're seeing the rise of American designers like Jamie Stegmaier and Isaac Childre, Isaac Vega, you know, and various others. And they definitely have a different style to your classic, for want of a better word, of German-style game designer. You know, when you look at the kind of stuff they do and the kind of stuff that Rainer Knizia or Wolfgang Kramer do, there's a massive gap between them. So, and I think the American market is, yeah, definitely changing things in all sorts of different ways. Also, it's because I think Board Game Geek, which is one of the biggest, obviously the biggest arenas for discussing games, I'm guessing the vast majority of people on there are American. And that does impact on the kind of conversations that people have. It has an impact on what kind of games get a lot of buzz. I don't know how you would analyze that change, but it definitely feels like things have changed a lot since when I first started designing games.
And what about the Australian market? Is it growing, or it is, how would you compare this market to other markets?
It's definitely growing. It's still small. I mean, Australia's only got 25 million people, mm-hmm. so it's not a massive population. I would say it was more influenced by the American market than the German one. To summarize it, so there is a market here, but if you're a game designer or a game publisher, you couldn't survive on the Australian games market alone. I think there's one company that kind of produces kids' games or more family games that just focuses entirely on the Australian market. But I mean, it's like you've got a copy of Unfair behind you from Good Games, which is an Australian-based company. They still have to sell their games outside of Australia to make the numbers that they need to make it worthwhile. So the Australian market, I think for some people, is kind of seen as like an adjunct to the American market. The good thing over here, there's a lot more people getting into games. There are a number of game shops in Brisbane, there are a number of games clubs around, so it's growing over here. So it's not a wilderness. You know, there's enough people play games for me to find play testers, which for me is the important thing.
Sounds really good.
I think it's a very interesting point because Jamie also said that the US market is, as you said, exploding. And so for 10 or 20 years, everyone thought that the German market is the biggest one for Euro games or board games. Mm. But now we are not on the first place at this moment.
No, America, I think when you are designing a game now, you have your eye on the American market. It used to be when I first started, you were totally focused on the German market. What will sell in Germany? Mm. And that meant there were certain themes that were just off limits, the design approach you would take, that kind of game you would do, there'd be low conflict, it would be much more about trading, cooperation, or, but there would be very rarely direct conflict. Because this is something that the German games market was felt to be a bad thing for games in Germany. Whereas the Americans, as we know, are quite happy with conflict. They love starting fights all over the place. So what you can design now has changed from what you were kind of forced to design then. For me, I think it's been a positive thing because I think German games are always about clever mechanics. It was always about a very simple core mechanic, not long games, but, just some neat little idea at the center of the thing, but generally quite abstract. Whereas American games, it's much more about theme. And I'm kind of in the middle. I like theme. I also like elegant mechanics. And it's really trying to bring those two together. But knowing that there's a market in America that appreciates theme means that sometimes you can make those things less elegant or more complicated than you need to be because there is a market for those games in America.
And so when you designed Anno, Wolfgang said that he asked you if you could mention to design a game in the universe of Anno. Do you design the game So when you say that if you design games, you have to look for the American market, but Anno is more mechanic. It's more, I think it feels more to be a game on the German market. Do you design the game more for this audience here, or is it in the middle?
To be honest, I think Anno could do quite well in the American market. I mean, Anno is unusual in that it's based on a computer game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Wolfgang didn't come to me and said, oh, can you design us a game about industry in the 19th century? He said, no, we want a game on Anno 1800. And so at that point, it's like, okay, so you're not thinking about whether it's suitable for the German or American market. It's like, how do you best do justice to the computer game? And the problem with computer games is there's an awful lot in them, especially Anno. I mean, it's crazy. It's got a ridiculous amount of resources. So, you know, my first challenge was like, how do I deal with all of these resources? You know, in that, you know, in most of my games, I only have like two or three different resources. You know, I have gold, coal, iron. You know, you don't have a wide range of resources. And Anno is all about resources. I mean, that's entirely what it's about. And that was the thing that flummoxed me. That was the thing that is a major challenge for me. And also, I don't play computer games. So, I mean, I really don't play computer games. So, okay, I've got to design a game on a computer game, and I don't play computer games. So, you know, I started by watching YouTube, and then, you know, because you know how YouTube, they'll have playthroughs. And they're really dull. So I actually ended up, one of my gaming friends plays computer games. I actually paid him money to play the game and then tell me what it was like. Because you have to play one of these games at least 30 or 40 hours before you get to see what's really going on. So he played it and he gave me a general overview. And then that gave me the insight that I needed to go, right, okay, let's just focus on the resources. Let's cut them down in number. And basically the game is built around a tech tree where resources feed into other resources. And that's the core of the game. And once I had the core of the game, it's like, yeah, it all came together really quickly, actually. In fact, I mean, the very first version of the game I designed, we actually played it all the way through, which is very unusual for a first-time game design. But what's interesting, the person who did the played the computer game for me, Stephen Hearn, he is interested in game design, and he's, you know, worked on a number of game designs himself, but he's now actively working on the solo version because he plays a lot more games solo than I do. So he's working on the solo version, and he's also helping me with the expansion for that because it's working on all this kind of new downloadable content. So he's at the moment, he's off playing all of that, and then he's going to tell me about that, and then we'll work on some new stuff for Anno. So that I don't normally work that way, so that's an unusual one. But I think I'd like to think that if from, you know, Americans who don't know the computer game, still play the game and enjoy it for what it is, because I think whenever you, well, certainly for me, if you're designing a game based on something like a computer game or a book or something like that, it still has to work as a game. You can't get away with doing something which isn't up to standard, just hoping that the theme, the IP, will carry it over. It's like, no, it should still be a good game in its own right. And I think Anno is.
Yeah, when Anno arrived in German market in October, when the Spiel would probably Potty and I already talked about the Cosmos titles. They are very strong titles this year or this period. And maybe Anno, your game, could possibly be the next German Spiel des Jahres. So maybe it can get a prize. Are you... could you cope with that? That you say, yes, I can think this could be a strong title for this prize in 2021?
It used to be many years ago, I always had my eye on Spiel des Jahres, you know, be like, yeah, it'd be really nice to win it. Because it used to be in the old days, the only way of really making money was to win the award and then you sold a ton of games. Nowadays, I'm not so bothered about it. You know, if it happened, great. If it doesn't happen, doesn't matter. Because the thing is, most of the money I earn at the moment, it comes from the sales of Brass. And that's never going to win Game of the Year because it's way too complicated. But the market's changed where you can make money from selling complex games now, which you could never do when I first started. So, yeah, it would be great to be just being nominated would be great. But if it doesn't happen, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it.
Sounds good.
The best way to be, just be relaxed about it. You know? I mean, the positive for me is that the mechanisms from Anno have also given me some ideas. I've developed those mechanisms for a Civilization game. So it's not just a one-off. It's something where it's like, yeah, by going down that, being forced to go down that route and solve the problem of, you know, how to design a game based on Anno is given me some ideas about how I can develop other games. So it's all been a positive experience.
Good. But Daniel, I have to interrupt because I don't think that Anno could be the game of the year in Germany because it's too complicated. It's a little bit too complicated. So game of the year, it's for families and there have just two pages of the rule book. But maybe it could be. I also think that it could win an award, but not the game of the year because that's for families. So 8 years plus. And I know it's a bit more complicated for
this. Yeah, but could I be possibly the Kenner Spiel des Jahres. This could be possible.
Maybe.
And the thing that's also, I don't know if it's in the rules, but generally games based on an IP, I don't think are listed for Game of the Year because it's felt they already have an advantage, I think. Mm. So, but we will see.
Okay. So I think let's break up with the comments because I don't want to break the flow. We are now talking about Martin and his work. So ich hoffe, wir nehmen uns das nicht krumm, dass wir jetzt einmal ganz kurz, dass wir die Kommentare heute mal ein bisschen kürzer halten, einfach weil wir gerade so schön drin sind. So Daniel, you are the philosopher. Would you like to start with the first question, or can I ask?
Yeah, I already asked a few questions, so I noticed some. We can continue because you mentioned one or two sentences ago. Mechanic versus theme was one question I noticed. So you are in a position that you can produce or design games as you like, I think. Yep. So you don't have to follow some rules or you have to fulfill a contract that somebody say, can you design this game? How do you create games? Are you a person who says, oh, I have such a good mechanic and we will match that with a theme? Or do you say, I have a theme and I design a game around that theme? So how do you proceed?
Most of the time I start with theme, you know, and then I find mechanics. So start with a theme and then work out who your market's going to be. So for instance, a New Zealand friend of mine, Amanda Milne, who I worked with in Australia, she had an idea for a game about rock music. And I said to her, rock music games, you know, music games generally are bad. You know, they don't sell. They're not very good. I said, no, that's a terrible idea. But then I went away and thought about it. I thought, well, what about a fantasy rock game? I mean, what about a game where it's kind of like Dungeons and Dragons world, but instead of being medieval, it's now the 1960s, so that you have these bands traveling around the country, and instead of you going around killing goblins, now they're your audience. Okay, so they're the people listening to your music. And I went back to Mandy and I said, I think we could make that work. So this is something we're working on together at the moment. But the interesting thing is, okay, so you've got a theme, and then I'm thinking, right, nowadays, what seems to be selling, or you know, given this is a game going on Kickstarter, what they like on Kickstarter is they seem to like legacy games. So, okay, so now this is going to be a legacy game. It's not just going to be a simple board game where you travel around and just do stuff. There's going to be a story involved. So then I'm thinking, okay, so we're doing a legacy game. So what's the best way of being able to play a game in installments where you can play a game for a certain period of time and then pack it up and then start a game later on? And the best solution to that is a deck building game, because, you know, you during the course of the first episode, you acquire cards, and then to pack it up, you just put those cards in a bag, and then the next game, you start with the cards that you acquired from the last game, so that you don't have a complicated board state. So that's just giving you an example of how you start with a theme, and then it's like, okay, what mechanics are going to be required to hit that theme? Okay. Mm-hmm. Nearly all of the time I start with a theme. And then it's just trying to think, how do I want to make the players feel? How do I bring this theme out the best that I can bring it out? And what's interesting, again, going back to the Monster Rock game, it's not what you think it is, because you think, oh, it's just a game about playing to audiences. But without wanting to give much away, there is a bigger story. When you first start playing a game, you think that's what it's about. But as you go through the episodes, like, no, that's not really what the game is about. That's just a backdrop. And actually, there is a overarching story that you are in. But I'm not going to say anymore, because that would be a spoiler.
Okay. Martin, so you say that you start with a theme. When I did a bit research about your life, so you worked full-time at Games Workshop.
Many years ago,
but do you have ever thought about designing a game in the universe of Games Workshop, maybe Warhammer or something like that? Or do you ever talk to people from Games Workshop, because now you're very popular and well-known game designer? So
yeah, it's funny you should say that. The thing is, when I've worked for Games Workshop was Ian Livingston and Steve Jackson. Mm-hmm. And then they sold up, and that's when Games Workshop became evil. So I couldn't deal with the modern Games Workshop, because it's very difficult to deal with them for IP. But I am working with Ian Livingston. Ian Livingston asked me to design a board game based on the Fighting Fantasy books. Mm-hmm. So I'm working with Ian on that. And there's also a side project, which when I mentioned earlier about doing role-playing stuff, I'm also working on some one-deck, one-play dungeon crawl games that are also based on the Fighting Fantasy book. So this is something I'm pretty excited about, is the idea of where you've got a very simple to play adventure game, you know, very quick to set up, simple to play, but fun. Mm-hmm. You know? So, in that sense, my original connection with Games Workshop has now actually come back and allowed me to work with Ian on this, because even though back in those days he was the owner and I was just like the guy in the shop behind the counter, I was the lowest of the low. But we did used to bump when I first went to Essen. He used to go to Essen, so that's actually where I got to know him, was at Essen. Although he doesn't go there anymore. But I am working on some Games Workshop related stuff, but the old Games Workshop, not the new.
before it comes evil, as you said. So for our tabletop fans, I started tabletop playing and Warhammer playing when I was 16, and I started playing Warhammer 40K. So what was your favorite system?
Me? I was playing games long before that. So, I used to play miniature games, but this is before fantasy. So it would be like Romans or Napoleonic. Then I got into Dungeons & Dragons when that first came out. But I never got into the kind of mod, you know, stuff like Warhammer or stuff like that. Because I was too old by then. I wasn't their target group. I wasn't their focus group. So you say favorite system. I think I never really thought of things in terms of that. I there are certain games that I like, but there's no favorite system. I've kind of drifted, you know, from I've done role playing, I've played war games, you know, stuff like SPI, Avalon Hill, you know, things like Squad Leader, you know, pretty heavy war games. I've played all sorts of different Euros. So I've kind of covered quite a large range of different games. I don't have a favorite system.
Okay. But Martin, you could never be too old to play to play tabletop games. I have friends, they're over 60 and play Warhammer 40K and Age of Sigmar.
Yeah.
The thing is, I mean, the kind of figure games I suppose, when I was back in the UK, I used to, every year I would go to this convention. It was a special convention. It was all about people designing their own figure games. But it was more experimental stuff. And that's when I used to play figure games. But these were games where people had made up their own rules, but they were very different from the kind of stuff that you'd find from Games Workshop. Very different indeed. So, yeah, that's when I would play figure games. But it's a lot of effort painting figures. I used to do that, but I've given up that. It's just too much effort.
But Daniel has a special technique, so you can paint 100 miniatures in 20 minutes, and they are looking like your...
But they look rubbish. They probably look awful. Looking
perfect.
Yeah, okay.
Kind of running gig. But at the moment, it takes nearly weeks for just two miniatures. So it's not the time for me to paint miniatures. There will be better times soon.
One last question about Games Workshop. There was, I think it was in Newcastle. You know the Warhammer World? I think it was a special place which was built from Games Workshop where you could, like a museum. Is it called museum? And in the past. So now Games Workshop just working on plastic, and in the past there was figures of, I think it's called tin.
The figures used to be made from a mixture of lead and tin. Trying to think of what the closest name, but they were lead figures, just with a bit of tin just to harden them up. Those were the original Games Workshop figures, because it's a lot easier to cast. It's a lot easier to make a mold for a lead figure than plastic. Plastic was then very expensive. One of the original, there was two people who used to design for Games Workshop in the early days called the Perry Twins. You probably never heard of them, have you? No, it's just I only heard of them because my regular artist back in those days, Peter Dennis, he used to know them. And these guys are very, very talented figure gamers, but they also enjoyed doing historical reenactments, you know, like English Civil War stuff, where you would dress up as a soldier and lots of you would get together on a big field and you'd fire guns at each other. And both of them lost one of their hands in a cannon accident. Okay. So they both of them lost a limb. And it was, I think, you know, if they're right-handed, they lost their right limb. So both of them actually had to learn how to sculpt using their other hand. But also, they were in New Zealand. They were actually, because they'd lost limbs, they used to get work in films as injured soldiers because they had a missing limb. And they ended up doing in Lord of the Rings because they, where they ended up doing work for Peter Jackson, where, because Peter's really into Gallipoli. And he was working on this massive diorama with lots and lots of figures. And the Perry twins saw what he was doing, said, oh, those figures aren't very good. We could do better. So he actually employed them to sculpt the figures for this big diorama. And a number of years ago, I was in Wellington, and it was, I think it was like 2014 or something. Anyway, so it was, they just opened up a big exhibition on the First World War. And I knew that Peter Jackson had been working on this, and I thought it'd be really interesting to see this. So I managed to track down where the diorama was. And you understand what a diorama is, you know, it's like this kind of big scene with lots of figures. And this diorama was massive. I mean, it was so big, they had to cut a walkway through it. And the detail on it was amazing. But yeah, that's kind of Games Workshop story about the early days of Games Workshop. Cool. And the Perry twins.
The Perry twins. So Daniel, now we know the Perry twins. Daniel, you are looking like you have a big question.
I have always question. Are there any topics you would rather work today than tomorrow on? Or are there some topics you would say, I would never, ever work on such a topic? Or are there future plans that you say, I would like to work on such a topic, but I don't know how to start?
I stay away from anything after 1945 in terms of war games. So I would never do anything on Vietnam or modern conflict. I think last year a company approached me to work on a computer game about the colonization of Africa. It's like, no, not going there, not touching that with a barge pole. So I would generally stay away from themes which are controversial in that sense, because it's just not even worth going there, which is why increasingly I tend to now use a fantasy background. So I mean, Australia is an example of that. In that, Australia was a game where I wanted to deal with the colonization of Australia, but avoid the issue of the indigenous tribes people. And so you put it into a fantasy world and you can kind of sidestep that. You can have the geography without the history. I mean, in terms of theme, the only thing I can do, any theme I want, the only themes I can't do are those themes that are directly tied to intellectual property. So, and the bizarre thing is, actually, I've already designed games on some of those. So I'll give you an example. You know, years ago, I designed a game on the Silmarillion. I don't know if you know the Silmarillion. It's basically the part of the Lord of the Rings. But the rights, I can't get the rights. Similarly, a couple of years ago, I designed a Harry Potter game, which works really well, but I can't get the rights because it's just too difficult to get the rights for those. So I'd love to do a really good Game of Thrones game. And I kind of know a route for getting the rights, and I'm kind of thinking, do I want to do that again? Because generally the way I work when it was something like that, I usually design the game first and then try and get the rights afterwards. That's the way I work with Discworld. And it's a lot of work to do that. And you're never sure if it's going to be a payoff. Because I always like to prove that you can do the game first before saying, can I do a game on such and such a thing? So if I was going to get the rights to Game of Thrones, I'd have to design the game first. I'm like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to spend the time on that now. But I've got plenty of ideas for themes, plenty of stuff for the future.
So that's good for us. Good information.
Yes.
Yeah, I think Game of Thrones would be a good topic, but I can imagine that it's very difficult. And especially for the German market, the high times of the high times is the wrong word. So the highlight times for Game of Thrones nearly is over. So
but the thing is, it's not about okay. there are some themes which I think will still sell, and I think Game of Thrones would still sell. I think for me, the idea would be to do a game that does justice to the theme, that it feels epic, but doesn't take as long as the Fantasy Flight game.
Yes, sure.
It's about having a more accessible game. So it's not dumbing it down. It's not making it a simple one-hour game. I would be looking to do, say, a 2 to 3 hour Game of Thrones game, so you can play it comfortably in an afternoon, which you can't do with the Fantasy Flight game. I think that takes a ridiculous amount of time. So it's trying to meet that thing of giving somebody a chance to play in that universe, and it feels good, it feels right. It's not just part of it, you know, you're playing the whole thing, but you can still do it in a reasonable amount of time. You know, that would be my objective, which is kind of my approach to pretty much any theme. You know, you're trying to give as much as that theme as possible, but without it taking too long to play.
I would be a buyer from the first hour on if you present such a game for us. So Potty gave us his cover. So I already own the Eiserne Thron is the German Fantasy Flight title game. It is unplayed here in my collection because nobody will spend time. Everybody says, "Oh no, it's too long." The rules are seem complicated. I don't know exactly how it plays then, but this is a problem that the game has that you have to.
You know, back in when I was playing games, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, long games it didn't matter because there were so few games around that you would play long games. It wasn't a problem. But now, with so many games available, I think playing time is a critical part of game design.
Absolutely.
You know, people make that, you know, judgment. It's like, right, okay, how do, you know, you have X number of gaming hours in a week and you decide where you're going to spend those gaming hours. And if something's going to take 8 or 9 hours, it's like, no, I would rather play Terra Mystica for a couple of hours and I'll play Great Western Trail or whatever, you know. I think it is game, one of those things that when, as a game designer, you are constantly aware of playing time.
Yeah, for sure. So last year we had the first Potty weekend. So one weekend just playing board games. And we have one round of Twilight Imperium. And there are some guys who said, no, I don't want to play it because in this time I can play 3 or 4 other games. Why should I use this weekend to play one game like this? So it's a difference in thinking about it because I said it's the perfect event to play this one. So we have 3 days and there's 1 day, a half a day. So we played it in 7 or 8 hours to play this one. And I can understand why people say, no, I just want to have a big variance on playing games. So,
that's a
big it's funny. Yeah, because I played Twilight Imperium for the first time a couple of months ago. And it put me off the fact that it was so long, but I figured, no, at some point I want to try it. And it is long, but it is epic, and I would play it again because it's funny, the length is part of the game.
Yeah,
with that.
Yes, truly.
It's an odd thing in that, and it's odd when you get people say, oh, if we couldn't make this take 2 hours, and I'm like, yeah, but then it wouldn't be the same game. Some games, they have to take a certain amount of time to play. That's part of what they are.
I think Twilight Imperium wasn't Twilight Imperium if it doesn't use this length of gameplay. So if you want to play this game, you are sure. So, okay, today I have 1 day playing this game. It would be epic.
Yep.
And I would dive into this world and just enjoy.
Yes.
Yes, that's exactly the point, because there was one episode we were discussing such problems, as you mentioned, Martin. This was the fact that we have such an amount of games. So I nearly own 320 games. So when I have a day and we play games, you are discussing let's play these two or three games. So the length would be or has to be comfortable. But there's, on the one hand, we have the experience that we say it doesn't mind if we play three games or one epic game, because the experience in general is important. But I'm by your side when you say Twilight Imperium is an epic game, and you know when you play this game what is the goal of the game. So you have a whole day with a bunch of people and enjoy it. But that is missing in such games like the Iron Throne, the Eiserne Throne. So many people say, I won't spend that time for that. And that's the dilemma of nowadays game designers, maybe. So you have to design a game that fits into the time space for people. Should be epic, but it should be epic in 1 hour would be the best way for the person who plays the game. But it's difficult.
Yes. It is difficult to do. Certain games, they definitely take. It's in the same way that with films, you know, you can't have a Marvel Avengers film that takes 90 minutes.
No,
they're always 2.5 to 3 hours because it needs that length of time to feel big. Mm. You know, if it was a 90-minute film, you would feel cheated. So, and I think it's the same with certain games. It's like with Civilization games. I think you can't have a decent civilization game that will take an hour, because it wouldn't feel epic. It would just feel like any other hour long kind of abstract game. So I always feel a Civilization game is always going to take a minimum of 3 hours just to feel like you're part of a longer story.
Martin, that's a good hint you're giving. So it's not the first time you're talking about Civilization games. And so when I was doing a little bit research about you, I found a passage that two of your favorite themes and are on one point is Civilization, and the other one is the train theme. So why this passion for these two themes?
The Civilization thing is, it's just because I'm interested in history, and you know, one of the interesting things about history is the way that societies have developed over time, and so that trying to come up with a game that reflects that for me is probably the biggest challenge in game design, and I also feel that, you know, there are a lot of Civilization games out there, but none of them are any good. They're either too long or they just don't do history. I think there's a lot of Civilization games that are just based off the computer game Civilization, and I don't think the people who designed them have ever read a book on history in their life. I mean, I don't think Sid Meier's ever read a book on history, because I don't think there's any history in Civilization computer game. It's not based on any form of civilization that I'm aware of. It doesn't map with the reality of the way that countries, nations, civilizations develop. So for me, that's the interesting thing, is how to try and put some historical realism into a civilization game without it being too complicated or taking too long. Mm. The railway thing is purely accidental, in that I was never into railway games until John Borer of Winston Games asked me to design a railway game. And I ended up designing a whole load of them, mainly because railway games are network games, and games where you're building things are inherently satisfying. It's always interesting when I see somebody design a game about where your world gets smaller. And they never work, you know, they all like decline of an empire or where things falling apart. People like building things and building line, you know, building railroads or building power lines or building roads or whatever is just somehow satisfying in the same way that a good macaroni cheese is satisfying. It is comfort food for board gamers. So, and so it is a theme I've gone back to repeatedly because it matches economics with geography. Mm. And I think there's a lot of game designers, they miss out on geography. They don't take into account, you know, how a board game can reflect geography. But geography is an important part of game design.
Yeah, very, very cool. I also own Age of Steam. And Age of Steam is, I played it the first time and I said, wow, such a pretty cool game. I love the way you are guided through the phases with the separate boards. You can play it on a small table because you just have the map and the separate boards for the faces, and then you just have your poker chips for the money and your trains, and that's it. And I think this game is, and it's also a bit, it has a bit, a little part of a conflict because you can build your trains around the table so that other one can't use it. You have to build it over because if you don't, the other one can continue. And there are so many very interested mechanics. So I'm very, very happy with this game. And the next one I have to play, I really, really have to play, but because I have to wait that Corona ends, is A Struggle of Empires. Because I think the special thing, maybe you can say some words about the game. I think the special game is to build the I don't know, coalitions?
Alliance.
So, and I think that's a very special point. How or why or how does Struggle of Empires was rising up in your mind?
So I started designing Struggle of Empires probably in 2001, 2002, something like a long time ago. And it was just a suggestion of a friend of mine. A lot of my game ideas come from suggestions from friends where they say, oh, why don't you do a game on such and such a thing? And I think somebody must have mentioned, one of my playtesters, I think, had suggested the 18th century. So I went away, did some reading, and it just struck me that all of the wars, and there are a lot of wars in the 18th century, and it was always two sides. You never had a three-sided war. It was always one alliance versus another alliance. And that became the core of the game. And so the key part of the game is where you use a bidding mechanic to decide which side you're going to be on. So the interesting part of the game is looking at the board state and saying, right, okay, where do I want to expand? You know, where do I want to be able to put my armies and expand? Where do I want to be able to defend what I've already got? And so the interesting thing with the alliance is, very often you want to ally with your enemies, because if you can ally with your enemies, they can't attack you. So you ally with the people who can hurt you, and then you try to make sure you're at war with those people who can't hurt you as much. So it's a very interesting dynamic. So the actual combat rules themselves are very simple. You know, everything, you know, there are no complicated rules in the game as such. It's more a case of reading the board state and working out, okay, where do I want to be, you know, which side do I want to be on, and how much money am I willing to pay to be on that side? So, yeah, it's still, I think, probably still holds up. Well, it's a long time since I played it, but it's good to see a new version of it.
Yeah, that could be my last question, so that Daniel also can ask some more. How do you feel with the new versions? Because Eagle Griffin Games are publishing Age of Steam in a new way, Struggle of Empires, these are deluxe versions with new components and big packages. So are you feel comfortable with them? Are you happy with them?
Do you, I'm guessing you didn't do any research on my relationship with Eagle Griffin then.
No.
No. Okay. Right. The thing with Struggle of Empires is I sold that design outright to Glenn Drover of Eagle Games many, many years ago. So I no longer own the rights to that game. So I don't get any royalties from it. Age of Steam was actually stolen from me and printed without my permission, but I'm not meant to mention that because we've had numerous legal battles over the years, and we did come to, the last one was over brass. And so, well, we've kind of buried the hatchet now, and they can just go off and do what they do. And we don't use lawyers anymore, thankfully. But I don't make any money from Age of Steam. I don't get any royalties.
That's a pity.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, huh?
Oops. In Germany, we say oops.
Yeah. Oops. Yeah.
So that would be a question I had. Was it your real own decision to bring new editions of some older games like Brass? What was the concept that you say, I want to change something and I want to facelift, or maybe I want to change the design, or as well with Tinnis Trail. Tinnis Trail is an older game as well, if I recognize it.
To be honest, it's all purely accidental. I mean, take Brass, for example. Mm-hmm. I had no idea at all about re-releasing it. And originally, I was actually going to sell the rights to Fantasy Flight, just because I needed some money. And then that actually fell through because Eagle Griffin was still, without me knowing it, was still publishing the old version of Brass. And they kind of killed the deal. But that's when Roxley came in and they said, look, we can possibly get the rights. We'd love to do the game. And that was purely accidental. And it turned out, you know, eventually I was able to resecure the rights to it. I licensed it to Roxley. And I had no idea that it was going to be as successful as it was. It was just amazing. And there was no predicting it. I mean, it's a long game about the Industrial Revolution in Lancashire. I mean, who the hell is going to buy that? There was no planning at all. Tinnis Trail, similarly, it's just, you know, I get companies that come to me and say, well, have you got any of your older games that we could do? And it's like, yeah, I've got this and I've got that. We've got the other, and some things they say, yeah, we think we can do that. Others, it's like, no, we can't do that. See, the problem is there's a lot of my game designs that I've sold outright. So I don't have the rights, for instance, to A Few Acres of Snow, because I know Roxley would love to do a reprint of that, but I sold those outright to Asmodee numerous years ago. So I've only got rights to certain of my games, because back then, you never reprinted games. So it's like, some of the games I did early days, Warfrog, things like Liberté and Princes of Renaissance. You know, after we printed them, you'd sell a couple of thousand and that would be it. So if somebody offered you a lump sum, the rights, it's like, yeah, fine, I'll take that, because there wasn't the market then that there is now. If I'd known now what I know then, I wouldn't have sold anything outright. I would have kept it all, but you don't know what the future holds.
I looked it up. Brass is on place 3 of BGG right now. So it's a real big success. So the German older version was Kohle, and Potty is Kohle, ne?
Kohle. Yeah. Yes.
Cool. Yes, this was a quite good game, but you can't know, or you couldn't imagine that this would be such a big success. So it's but in general, you have to say the game is a piece of art. So the whole design, your mechanics, so it's the way it is presented nowadays,
yes,
was such a big success nevertheless, because this is good piece of work. So
It's a company. I mean, the artwork is outstanding, especially the Birmingham cover. I think is amazing. It's a really good cover.
a real eye catcher.
Obviously, you know, they're a fairly new company would come to me, but they were getting Kickstarter right. And there are some companies who do Kickstarter really well. And the thing with Kickstarter is as long as you keep getting it right, your sales will go up. It's when you screw up. If you mess up on Kickstarter, then you're dead. You know, if you upset your fan base, then you're done on Kickstarter. But as long as you go on there and you offer a good product and you deliver it on time, then you will gain backers for your next project. And so Roxley are on that upward curve. I mean, you can see Jamie Stegmaier is a perfect example of that upward curve of, you know, started well, but then he built on that. And each game after that would do, you know, an order of magnitude better than the previous one. And so, yeah, when you're looking to license games to companies, one element you look at is like, do they have a good Kickstarter reputation? Because if they don't have a good Kickstarter reputation, then you don't want to license to them.
Yes, sure. So you give your name for a product, and if a company ruined. So
a very popular example for things like these are Golden Bell Studios. There was a Kickstarter with what's called Unbroken, and it was
a small
solo game which should at cost for, I think the backer had to pay $23 or $28, and it was rising up in the campaign, and everyone said, wow, such cool, you get so big materials for this low price. And there was the designer of the game now has big problems, because everyone says, so you're working with Golden Bell, so then you're a part. So the most of the people doesn't know that just the designer has just designed the game, and it's just his name on the package, and everything which with fulfillment, production, shipping, he don't have to do anything with this. But now he has some problems and is trying to talk about it and to say to the people, hey, I can't do anything for this problem. Yes. And he want to rescue everything he can. But yeah, and now I think the campaign is over for about 2 years, and maybe the half of the backers doesn't receive their copies because the package is too big. And so they are talking, hey, we need more money to ship, to pay the shipping cost. And everyone says, I don't pay $10 more when the game is at a cost of $28. And
you have to be very careful on Kickstarter. There's so many disaster stories. I mean, it's scary because I'm planning on doing a Kickstarter later this year, and I wouldn't normally do that, but I've got a game design that I've been working on for years, but it's the game itself is very expensive to produce, so I can't license it to another company, because the only way I can do it is by selling it direct to the consumer. And Kickstarter obviously is the perfect way of doing that. Because this game cannot go into retail because it would cost $200. It would be stupid amount of money. It's just because of the nature of the components in it. It's just because of the way I want the game to be produced makes it very expensive. So, and it's scary me, the fact that I'm going to be doing a Kickstarter, because they're very complicated to do now, a lot more complicated than they used to be. And there's a lot can go wrong. And there's so much more competition out there with Kickstarters. So what I'm trying to do at the moment is make sure I've got the right people, you know, getting people around me who know how to run this thing properly. You know, you could get away with being an amateur before, but I think now you can't do that on Kickstarter. Everything has to be so professional.
For sure. Absolutely. Okay, so at the end of the year, you will do a Kickstarter campaign. So when have Daniel and I watch on Kickstarter?
I'd like to say it's going to be around April, but...
Oh, early.
It depends. I was aiming for that. The thing is, at the moment, the game's called Bloodstones. And the key thing is it uses plastic tiles. Think of kind of Mahjong tiles. So your army is made up of these tiles. And originally they were going to have icons sculpted into them, but that was too expensive. So now I'm looking at a heat transfer process. But the first, and the thing is, I need to have a prototype made because the whole point of the game is to show people what it's going to look like in the final format. And that's the thing that's taking time. So I've had most of the artwork done, but the first set of pieces that they did, the printing process wasn't very good. So the art, it didn't look very good, the images. So now they're redoing them using a different technique. And that takes time. And we've probably got Chinese New Year coming up, so that's going to add more time. So things just take time. But I kind of figure what I want to do is get some prototypes made, send them out there, let people play the game. Because if people don't know enough about your game when you go to Kickstarter, if it's not enough reviews, if it's not enough comments about it, then people don't feel confident in investing in that. So it takes there's a long lead up time to launching a Kickstarter campaign. So I kind of figure, you know, it will happen when it happens. It will happen once I feel everything is right. And so if things slip by a couple of months, well, that's just the nature of the beast. So you just have to go when you're ready.
So if you need our address for the prototype, I will send it to you.
You can do that, and I'll be happy to send you a prototype.
So I have one. One last question. So, but you answered it by the way, nearly. My question is Kickstarter or retail? And you answered it. So if it fits for Kickstarter because of the production value, you could prefer that. And you have such a name that you can bring mostly games to Kickstarter. So there is sometimes the question, why Kickstarter nowadays? So I think 2 years ago, I was watching or looking up things at Kickstarter, nearly my daily business. So I was looking, is there something new? Can I back something? But the market is very quick, and my view changed a little bit because some shipping costs and some fees and taxes make Kickstarter not longer attractive to people. So they want to back such a premium product. So that changed. So this is a fact. I think that people are very angry with companies like Simon or something like this. When people say, Simon could launch games in other ways.
I don't think they could, not the big games. You need Kickstarter. Retail is a lot tougher now.
Okay.
And the thing is, I don't know how much more time ago. The interesting thing is, in the old days, the big companies were the ones who did the pretty games. You know, small companies like mine, you know, Warfrog, our artwork wasn't very good. Our production quality wasn't very good. But people didn't mind because it was about the gameplay. Whereas the big companies like Cosmos and Ravensburger, and they did the top quality artwork and top quality production. Now it's the reverse. If you look at the quality of production, those companies, and you compare it to the quality of Kickstarter games, the standard of the quality is much higher because they can sink their artwork costs from the money they make from Kickstarter. Whereas Cosmos, they can't because they're purely retail. So I know for a fact we're doing Anno. It's like, you know, they work to a strict budget in that this game has got to be 50 euros retail. Therefore, we have to produce it for, you know, our hard limit. As I don't know, maybe their production cost is going to be about 8 euros, and they can't go above that. And so that means they've got a very limited budget for artwork, a very limited budget for production. Okay, and they have to work within that. Whereas on Kickstarter, if you put a game on Kickstarter, you don't have to worry about those things.
This is a really good hint, because we are the consumers and don't know any aspect of selling games through Kickstarter. And mostly, as I said, people think, oh, why are they doing such things about Kickstarter? So it's very interesting hearing your point of view, because you're on the other side the working a chain.
Yeah.
Okay, very nice.
Okay.
I have also a last question, Martin. So in 1990, you started to develop your first prototype. In 1994, it was your first fair in Essen with your game. It was called Lords of Creation. Is it right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And before you started developing this game, or you've done a lot of different works, and the first question is, why are you decided to develop board games? Because you also worked 1 year as a computer game designer. So that's very funny because you said you don't want to play computer games. And the second one is, how do you feel? Have you felt at your first fair? So was very special to talk to these international guys about your game. And maybe the third question, are you connected to the other big game designers in the world?
Okay. so let's see how I can answer this. I suppose for some reason, back when I was about 29, 30, I decided that I wanted to try and be a game designer. At that point, I was working as a teacher and I didn't really like teaching. So for me, making money as a game designer was my dream because I figured it was an easy life. It took a lot longer to get there than I thought, but eventually, yeah, I was able to earn enough money to give up teaching, and I've worked as a full-time game designer now, I think since 2007. And I would never go back to a normal day job. It's still difficult at times making money because you never know what you're going to earn in a year, but it's great. So I always felt, because it's creative. So that was the thing, you know, that it's just something in me that I wanted to do. Going back to 1994 and the first Essen, that would be a program in itself. That was such an epic trip. It was incredible. And it was, for me, a big turning point in that that's what gave me the big break. And that at the very first show there, that's where I met Wolfgang. But back then, he was a journalist. So he was getting games and reviewing them. So I met him in 1994, and he took away a copy of the game. And then the following year, we went back. I think one of the years went back. We'd keep seeing the same people year. Every year they would come back and you'd get to know them. And so he came back to me and said, oh, I'm not a journalist anymore. I'm working for Goldsieber. And so he was the person who placed my first game with a German publisher, which was Unschuss, which I think came out in 1998. So, yeah, from that first year, you got to meet all sorts of people that later on in your life became very important for one reason or another. In terms of game designers, there's some that I get on, you know, we're kind of very solitary creatures in a sense, because we all tend to work in an office on our own. So, game designers, I mean, I used to socialize a lot with Franz Benno de Long because he was good fun, but unfortunately he passed away a number of years ago. If I see Rainer, I'll say hi. But we don't have long conversations. I recently got to know Eric Lang because I was at BGG in 2019, and he's good fun. He's a laugh. There are some game designers who are good fun. Others that I suppose it depends if they drink. If you find them in the bar, then I'm happy to hang out with them. If they're not in the bar, then I'm probably not going to get to know them. I think it's...
would be a funny situation.
Yeah, yeah.
So, hopefully we can drink a beer next
Essen. That's one of the things I'd say. Essen for me, when people say, do you play games in the evening? They're like, no, I'm in the bar. I'm eating steak and I'm drinking beer. I'm not playing games in the evening. I've got way more important things to do. Yeah.
Really great.
I think that's a perfect point to close the episode, Martin. Thank you that you
participated.
Yes. That's okay.
We have a big fun, and I think it was very, very interesting for us to get so many informations about you and your life and your work with board games. Daniel, do you have some last words?
My last words were it was a great pleasure for me talking with you. Such a sympathetic person. Hopefully we can meet once in this year in at a fee at a fair fee.
Yeah.
I lost the word, sorry, because I'm a little bit excited. I never ever expected meeting you online or in some way, but it was a great pleasure for me. It was very
happy to take part.
Yeah. Thanks. Gut, dann würde ich sagen, sind wir durch, Leute. Danke, dass ihr eingeschaltet habt. Wir sind natürlich gespannt, was ihr in die Kommentare haut. Und wir hoffen natürlich auch, dass es mit der Übersetzung alles klappt, so wie wir uns das vorgestellt haben. Für uns war es auf jeden Fall, wie Daniel schon gesagt hat, ein Big Pleasure, eine große Ehre. Und ja, danke fürs Einschalten, Leute. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Wir haben euch lieb. Daniel, es war schön. Martin, thank you that you had time.
Thank you.
Thanks for all.
So, bye-bye. Ciao.
Bye.